is the name of the blog and the name of the book. And really appreciate your time today, Chris.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, too. Thanks.
Straight from Oakland, California, home of the rock. Eight woofers in the truck beating down the block. Short dog, I'm that rapping man. I said it before and I say it again. Life is too short. Too short. Life is too short. Too short. Life is to some people unbearable. Commit suicide and that's terrible. Wasn't much too much. Or nothing big. If you live my life, you'll be fighting to live. Life is to me my main asset. I'll be doing alright and keep it just like that. Chill out at the house and bump that bass. I'm trying to get rich as I rock the place. Everybody's got that same old dream to have big money and fancy things. Got brand new Benz, keep your bank right here. Never hear me stutter once cause I talk real clear. It's on you, homeboy, what you gonna do? You can take my advice and start working, fool. Or you can close your ears and run your mouth. And one day, homeboy, you'll soon find out. Life is too short.
My friends, you're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and, you know, I'm here to make the case to you that we don't need a Department of Homeland Security. The Homeland Security Act should be repealed immediately, and any enabling legislation that created any Homeland Security agencies in the states across this union should all be repealed immediately as well. And any Heimatland security officer, that's in the original German, who has any honor, ought to resign today. What are you doing? Homeland Security? This isn't the old world. This isn't the land of national police forces. How could anybody think that what we need to do is adopt the German model of security? It was the traditional belief in this country, not that it's always been acted on perfectly, but the general sentiment has been that the more freedom for everyone, the better. That's how you'll have the best security, is when people are free to carry their own weapons. And when they're free to keep their own money and their government doesn't spend their money killing people overseas, making new enemies for them. That's how to be free. Buy a gun and tell your congressman to stop meddling in the Middle East. Not to let them expand their police powers. And who really wants to see a bunch of cops running around dressed up like Nazis? Wearing all black, oftentimes with their face covered with their black masks. German style helmets that look, you know, right out of World War II. MP5 Heckler and Koch machine guns. I don't know. Gee, seems to me like 3,000 dead is a bad deal, and we need to learn the lesson that it's not okay to treat people in the Middle East like they're less than human beings. Tends to piss them off, apparently. But the lesson of September 11th is not that we need to destroy our liberty. And, you know, I think it was L. Neil Smith, the great libertarian writer, who immediately, in 2001, came out and said, Homeland Security? That's what they called it in Germany. The Heimatland. We must all serve the Führer and the Heimatland. It reminds me of that TV movie from the 80s where the Soviet Union took over America. It's America spelled with a K. And the Soviets, much like the headlines indicate, the American establishment is talking about doing to Iraq, the Soviets divide America into three. And Robert Urich is the puppet dictator. He's the Russian al-Maliki ruling America, and the new country is called Heartland. Now, it's a revolution within the form, no doubt about it. And I think that anyone who works at any Department of Homeland Security anywhere in this country ought to resign today. And in fact, then you ought to turn right around and go down to your state legislature and tell them why police powers belong at the county sheriff level. Fine, fine, fine. You have your Franklin Delano Roosevelt created, you know, state trooper organizations and whatever to patrol the highways. Great. Yeah, but we don't need Homeland Security. There's no Al-Qaeda in Texas, guys. There's no Al-Qaeda here. You want to find Al-Qaeda? Some guy just turned into one in Iraq right now because of our occupation of that country. He just said, what? My cousin's been killed? That's it. I have no more reason to not spend the rest of my life trying to kill Americans. Somebody hand me an AK-47. Okay? There's your Al-Qaeda. They're not here. There's your terrorists. They're not here. And, you know, flip through your channels. I challenge anyone in the audience, particularly if you work at the Department of Homeland Security, just flip through your channels at night and watch these cop shows. Watch them with the volume off. And just flip through and see these cops acting like thugs. Acting like we were all brought up to believe governments act in the old world, not the way it is in America. You know, they get in a car chase and they do the pit maneuver at 60 miles an hour and flip guys off the highway down ditches. You know, attempted murder because, you know what, his license plate doesn't match or whatever. It might be a stolen vehicle, so you try to kill him. You know, some guy's holed up in his house, wants to commit suicide or has a hostage. And what do? They stand out there and say, look, we got you surrounded. Give up. Don't be a jerk. You don't want to do this. No, they come in and treat it like the Waco Holocaust. They put on their full body armor. They drive in with their armored personnel carrier, with their sniper rifles, M16s, and MP5 machine guns, flashbang grenades, full body armor, and face masks. You know, flip through those channels. Watch those cop shows, even if you don't see this happen in your neighborhood. It happens. It's happening every day in this country. We are turning our police into paramilitary organizations who will use deadly force over the most meaningless of offenses, who will use overwhelming force against people who pose no threat at all. You know, we're moving to the days of no-knock entries for any warrant. We are headed that way. As though every American citizen is an enemy, is to be treated as an enemy. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I saw in Cops, a cop said, well, there's two kinds of people in this world, suspects and victims. Now it's enemies and victims. At least a suspect has rights. At least a cop knows somewhere deep down his job description is to protect the rights of a suspect from other private parties who might do him harm for being the accused in a crime. But enemies, well, we know what happens to enemies. We throw grenades at enemies. We shoot rifles at enemies. And that's the way our government is coming to view us, the American people, more and more. And, you know, I can't help but figure out the fact it's pretty easy that all these cops are Americans, too. And they're all human beings and Americans before they're cops. And, why not resign? Why be part of the coming, the already existing and the ever expanding American police state? You know, why have the shame of working for something called the Department of Heimatland Security? The very notion of which ought to be repugnant to any American. I want to direct your attention at antiwar.com today. News about possible conflict between the Turks and the Kurds, as we've discussed on this show since the spring of 2003. This is the kind of house of cards we're building, setting up major disaster here. It's been more or less quiet. The PKK every once in a while goes into Turkey and blows stuff up, and the Turkish government, of course, oppresses the Kurdish minority in Turkey. And here's the scholars on antiwar.com, divide Iraq into three regions. Well, and this is from the Associated Press. With President Bush's war strategy clouded by limited results and mounting casualties, two scholars are proposing a partition plan that would divide Iraq into three main regions. The authors Edward P. Joseph of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and Michael O'Hanlon, Singer Fellow at the Brookings Institution, are hoping to draw the attention of Bush administration policy makers. Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, Democrat presidential candidate and chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has sought for months to attract support for a partition plan he formulated with Leslie Gelb, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations. It would establish a federal system of government in Iraq. Well, it would really establish more of a confederation than true federalism. And basically the plan, what they're saying here is they want to just go ahead and hand the South over to the Iranians, the ones that they never stop accusing. More on that with Greg Mitchell in a few minutes. And apparently they want to start a war in Kurdistan. And there's, to whatever degree Kurdish populations are restless in Syria, Iran, and Turkey, in the areas bordering Kurdish Iraq, when they have true autonomy, that pressure is going to go up by some significant percentage as Kurdish groups try to break away and join the new state of Kurdistan, which is only going to provoke war. You may not know how much, how many billions of dollars. In fact, I don't know how many billions, but I do know it was billions. You might not know that any money was spent at all over the last probably 50, but specifically the last 15 years or so on the Turks, giving them equipment and supplies and cash money in order to wage war on their own Kurdish population to keep them down. And so here we are. We got the Turks, who are our best friends, NATO members for 50 years, the bridge between the East and the West, if there is one in the world, and we're friends with the Kurds, who we've been backing in Iraq since 1990, whose autonomy we secured, Bill Clinton's policy of the no-fly zones and the blockades and all that to keep the Iraqi government out of the North. Yeah, that's right. Saddam Hussein controlled basically Iraq and, basically Baghdad and three or four other towns before the war. Didn't really have control over the South or the North. That's neither here nor there. The establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, centrist, quote-unquote, politicians like Joe Biden are pushing for dividing Iraq into three. Well, I guess we've let the death squads, the Shiite death squads that we've put in power as the new government of Iraq, we've let them almost completely purge the capital city, Baghdad, of its Sunni Arab population. So I guess it's okay. Now's the time to go ahead and hand the south of Iraq to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, right? Isn't that the way this goes? We back Iran in Iraq, and then we fight Iran in Iran. Something like that. There's a congressman, Robert Wexler from Florida, according to Raw Story, wants to censure Bush over the commutation of Libby's sentence. What is it going to take to get some congressmen with some balls in the House and the Senate of the United States of America? You know, George Bush's approval rating right now is 26%. That's at Nixon resignation levels, or within a couple of points. There's a bill to introduce articles of impeachment, at least against Dick Cheney, already in the House. And it's not just Kucinich anymore, he's got two or three more co-signers now. What are we waiting for? What are the Democrats waiting for? John Conyers. I almost got into a tangent on Conyers there. Hold your tongue, Horton. What the hell's going on with John Conyers? He can't introduce some articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee. You think that Bush and Cheney are not kidnappers and liars and torturers and murderers and wagers of aggressive war? That they're not in direct violation of Amendment Number 1, Amendment Number 2, Amendment Number 4, Amendment Number 5, Amendment Number 6, Amendment Number 8, Amendment Number 9, and Amendment Number 10 of the United States Constitution. The only one I left out there, I think, was the only two, quartering soldiers in our houses. They just tax us or counterfeit the money to pay for that and put them somewhere else. Keep the rest of us, away from that part of society as much as they can. Don't want our sickening, hateful ideas spreading. And then the civil trials over disputes over $20. Seventh Amendment, yeah, I don't think that one's really applicable. But they're in direct violation of the rest of the Bill of Rights. Tapping our phones, reading our emails, searching our bank accounts, all with no warrants whatsoever. They made up these new national security letters in the Patriot Act where basically a cop can give himself a warrant and search whatever he wants. The torture, the murder, the number of corpses in Iraq surpassing the dead from the Rwandan genocide of 1994. You're telling me that you don't have a case to remove George Bush and Dick Cheney from office? Remove him from office. Oh no, let's censure him. That's funny. I've read the Constitution more than once. And I don't see anything about, occasionally the Imperial Senate ought to express their disapproval with no force whatsoever. I don't remember seeing that in the Constitution. Censure him, huh? All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Read my blog, thestressblog.com. If you're a member of the Department of Homeland Security on the state or federal level, you ought to do the honorable thing and resign. I'm going to play a song, and we'll be right back with Greg Mitchell from Editor and Publisher. Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.
I'm crying. gonna do about it?
It's for you, you, you.
Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and that was Brutality, Inc. Our next guest today is Greg Mitchell. He fills an extremely important niche in the market of ideas. He reports on the reporters. He's the editor of Editor and Publisher. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm doing Greg. How are you?
I'm very good.
Oh, that's good to know. And I have a pet peeve of mine, who apparently walks around on two legs. His name's Michael R. Gordon, and I have the most trouble reading the New York Times and trying to keep my head from exploding when I read this guy's what do they call it? Reporting, is that what
All
they
right.
call it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and well, I noticed that you picked up on the same theme here, so I thought maybe I'd bring you on to talk about this article that came out, was it the 2nd or the 3rd, I'm sorry, of July by Michael Gordon, leveling apparently blind accusations against the state of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the biggest part of the story, well, there were two major parts of the story, I guess, right, was one that Iran is backing Hezbollah in Iraq.
Well, huh? Right,
and then
a scorecard to keep track of the players here.
Yeah, yeah, and then then Iran is behind the kidnapping and murder execution of American soldiers back in February
right.
in Karbala.
Right.
So I guess let's start with well, not just the facts, but Gordon's reporting on the facts in terms of Iran using Lebanese Hezbollah to train extremists in
right.
Iraq.
Well, this very question was raised with the U.S. spokesman who was that had the press conference this week. Who, you know, incidentally, had just arrived in Iraq from his most recent post in the White House. You know, reporters asked him, "Well, why would this is sort of roundabout getting Hezbollah to train, you know, militants in Iraq?" Why would they do that? Why would they go to all that trouble? Why not? Why do they have a couple middlemen there? And he had no answer for that. So, but you know, there's a lot of context here when you talk about Michael Gordon, and there's a lot of context for when this story appeared. I'm sure you're aware, and many of your listeners are aware that with the faltering U.S. effort in Iraq and the calls for withdrawal or some sort of drastic change of direction. Suddenly, the last few weeks, we have heard increasingly about Al-Qaeda is now the number one foe in Iraq, and two, that Iran is behind the most deadly weapons there and also funding the insurgency. So it's now those two things are plausible, but it's awfully suspicious that this has arisen. And they've tried everything else, every other bugaboo, every other effort to drum up support. And so on the surface, it just seems like a desperation measure for the military to now say, well, we've tried everything else. Let's blame everything on Al-Qaeda. We know that's kind of a winner with a lot of Americans. And Iran, here's the two biggest, outside of maybe Castro, the two biggest enemies in the public mind. So let's tie them more closely.
Right. And
so that's the context. You know, that's the context where you see this stuff and you sort of say, well, wait a minute here. It's, you know, again, it's possible, but it sure seems like it's propaganda that's meant to perk up the, you know, last chance for the U.S. effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you point out in your article, the accusation is that here Iran is using Hezbollah to train quote-unquote Iraqi extremists, which mm-hmm. is the very same line that we've heard for the last 6 months, really, since Bush came out and announced the surge and started threatening Iran in January.
Right.
And it's deliberately vague. I mean, there's no question about why they say Iraqi extremists, because if they say Iran is backing the Sunni insurgency, we'll say, hey, wait a minute. And if they say, well, Iran is backing the Badr Brigades, we'll say, oh, good, they're helping us train and equip the Badr Brigades. And,
right.
And then if they say, oh, well, they're backing Muqtada al-Sadr, well, he's the least Iran-tied of all the Shiite factions.
Right.
He's the nationalist, and he's not at war with the United States. So it's not plausible. They're lying, and they know they're lying.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as I said, it's hard to tell the players without a scorecard, and it gets very complicated because it's, you know, who are we helping? Who are we helping this week? But, you know, the other bit of context that's important here is Michael Gordon's role in the run-up to the war.
Mm-hmm.
He was with Judy Miller at the New York Times, wrote some of the most egregiously false stories, and was accused then also of the same thing, that he was taking the taking what he was being fed and doing some more reporting, doing additional reporting, but basically that it came up with a couple of the most the stories that were most influential and wrongly so in the run up to the war. So there's been this suspicion cast on him previously. So it's not sort of a blank slate. And then the final thing that I would say in regard to that is just in terms of the New York Times itself, is the prominence that they give his stories. It's one thing to run someone's stories put them on page 18 or 28 or whatever. But when you put them on the front page, it has a whole different meaning and impact. And, he has a front page story today in the Times. If your head hasn't exploded today, you should check it out. It's right on the top, near the top of the front page. And in it, he says a fairly remarkable statement after visiting a town in Iraq. He says, many Sunnis, for their part, are now less inclined to see the U.S. soldiers as occupiers now that it is clear that American troop reductions are all but inevitable. Now, if that doesn't make your head explode, I don't know what will. But, somehow the assertion that from his visit to one town here that Sunnis are around Iraq now no longer see the U.S. as occupiers is patently absurd. So, but there it is on the top of the front page. So, I mean, again, that's the context. There certainly there could be truth in what he's reporting, but you kind of have to look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what he refuses to do, right? That's like the signature of his reporting is here's this little fact and exclude it from all context. And a lot of times even the fact itself isn't right. But, going from what you just said about the story today, like, oh, you found one Sunni who said, the Americans were not worried so much because you're leaving anyway. And now that anecdote counts for what the Sunni population of Iraq thinks.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he's out there. He is on the ground there. And no doubt he's embedded, I presume. So he's being shown around by the military, which of course is already a compromising position. But you know, I mean, I wouldn't discount everything he writes. I wouldn't discount every fact or anything like that. It's just a matter of when you consistently read things where someone is seeming whatever the military line appears to be this week, his reporting seems to match that. Now maybe it's true. Maybe that's reflecting the reality on the ground. But it's awfully suspicious when his reporting seems to mirror whatever the Pentagon seems to be pushing this month.
Mm-hmm. And now, for a little bit of that context, you referred back to the run-up to the war and the importance of some of the stories that he co-wrote with Judy Miller.
Right.
I guess it's David Schuster on NBC's Hardball who put together this great little chart about the White House Iraq group and Judy Miller and Michael R. Gordon, mm-hmm. and how this is, I guess, the most famous case of the pre-war propaganda where Scooter Libby and the guys in the vice president's office leaked all this information to Gordon and Miller. They
right.
printed it in the New York Times, and then Cheney, Powell, Rice, and Rumsfeld all went on different Sunday morning news shows to say, see, it's even right here in the New York
right.
Times,
well,
aluminum tubes to right. enrich uranium. They're going to nuke us. We can't let the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud.
Right. Well, that's the famous September 8th, 2002 article, which was co-authored by Miller and Gordon, and then it was Cheney and everyone else went on TV. Sunday talk shows, and that's it. It's exactly what they said. They said, well, it's not just me saying this. Here it is in the New York Times. So that story was was tremendously influential. And that's the point. The stories were put and still are put on the front page. And what was remarkable in the run-up to the war is that there were occasionally, both in the Washington Post and the New York Times, there were stories that did cast doubt on some of the evidence for WMDs. But usually they were buried in the paper. And that's where placement comes in. You know, it's the scare stories are put on page one, and then the more moderating stories are on page 28. And so the more veteran reporters have more clout, and their work tends to get bumped up, and then some other stuff doesn't get as much attention. So that's a problem.
Well, now I'm kind of confused about the newspaper industry. It seems like, I don't know. Can you tell me when you guys all get together in some ballroom to do awards and ceremonies or whatever, does everybody not hiss at Michael Gordon? Is he not the least respected reporter in America? I mean that seriously. I mean, this guy's gotten almost a million people killed so far with his lousy reporting, convincing Americans to go along with this thing. We're counting in the high numbers of hundreds of thousands now in Iraq. Is there no shame in the newspaper industry? I mean,
well,
that seriously.
I've never been in a ballroom where he's gotten an award. I mean, we should back up and say editor and publisher is the sort of the independent magazine of that covers the newspaper industry for 120 years, and we have a very active and popular and influential website, which is editorandpublisher.com, and that's where the story that I wrote that you're referring to, and most of our other many stories related to Iraq and coverage of Iraq appears on our website, and so we have a very independent position, and I have to say we have been from before the war 5 years ago now have been raising alarms, raising questions, and being very critical of the coverage of the war, and often very very lonely in this. Extremely sort of out on the limb for what would be considered a mainstream publication that has been critical of the coverage in the war itself going back 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and that's why
I can't speak for others. You know, I can't speak for others within the year. We're not a newspaper ourselves, so I don't know how it's viewed. There's been a lot of tremendous coverage from individual reporters in Iraq. The funny thing is there's been an awful lot of great coverage mixed in with the not so great coverage in Iraq itself. At the same time, there's newspapers, and then something I've written about, 50 times is the amazingly few newspapers editorially on their editorial page have come out for a change of course in Iraq. So to some extent, the reporters on the ground have been providing more critical reporting than what the editors have been willing to do back home on their editorial pages.
Right. Well, and this is why I like editor and publisher so much. It's always very critical. And I guess, maybe I assume too much about, how well you know the rest of these people and that kind of thing. But it just seems to me like here you're writing this article, which, seems to have as its purpose to shame Michael R. Gordon for his lousy reporting. And I just wonder, where's everybody else on this? I love editor and publisher, but where's everybody else doing I want to see a news story in the L.A. Times called Michael Gordon is a corrupt reporter. The things he writes should not be believed by reasonable people.
Well, at least the L.A. Times editorial came out for a pullout from the war, which was kind of an amazing turnaround there.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really seen that appear in the mainstream. There's been, of course, plenty of blogs have attacked Michael Gordon and other people. But mainstream reporters they generally don't. And, he has respect from a lot of people in the mainstream, because he's reported a long time, and he did a book that was critical of a lot of the things that went on in the early months of the occupation. But there's a whole, there's a whole school of thought which many, even the David Brooks of the world, who have endorsed the war, supported the war, or waving the flag for years. They then take the position of, well, the war was a good idea and it just got screwed up by Rumsfeld and, mm-hmm. The occupation didn't go well and et cetera, et cetera. So, the Michael Gordons, I think, would fall into that camp where they kind of lament and have documented the screw-ups. But that doesn't mean that they feel that the war was a bad idea or even that it can still be won. And that's where... that's where so many people differ. And just for me, I think there are people, and we're starting to see it on editorial pages more and more. I have a big story yesterday that got a lot of attention. The newspaper in Tacoma, Washington, the Olympian, which is a small city, but it's very near two major an Air Force base in Fort Lewis, which is one of the main army bases that sends troops to Iraq. And this is a newspaper which came out on July 4th with a kind of a very brave editorial calling for a U.S. pullout. And would normally be no big deal, except it's been so rare around the country. So few papers have been willing to do that. And here's a paper that's, has a very strong military audience. And so they, they've taken this step. So I just think, and we now see, more conservative Republicans in Congress at least going halfway to calling for something. And yet, editorial pages are behind, we now have so-called liberal newspaper editorial pages who are actually behind right-wing Republicans on the war.
Do you have any idea why that is?
Chew on that one for a while.
Well, the public, according to the polls, I think the last one I saw, if you combine the two different levels, was 77% of the American people who are against this thing. Do you have any idea why it is that the newspaper editors are so far behind their audiences?
I haven't been able to figure. I've been writing about this for 4 years. And I think it's... they're afraid to be. Well, normally, you'd say they're afraid to be out front, but in this case, they can't be out front because they're already behind. It's almost like I did a lot of coverage of how the Washington Post, for example, explained why it was so wrong. Why it was one of the prime examples of a paper that ran like 120 stories on the front page about the Iraqi WMDs and, ran 20 stories that raised doubt and put them all on page 20. And the, one of the reporters, one of the editors there said, you know, said frankly, you know, we were afraid to be wrong. You know, we were afraid to say we don't think they're a WMD, and then, you know, it turned out that we were wrong. So I think there's some of that in this, where if you come out, first of all, if you come out against the war, then you have to explain, well, what would you do? What's your strategy? And then if you say, well, we want to start pulling people out, and then a year from now, the situation gets even worse there, if that's possible. And then people would say, well, you favored a pullout. Look what happened, you know. So I think in that sense, there's more danger in doing nothing. Now, my view would be that they've lost so much credibility and they've lost so many readers. I mean, I'm not saying that the big decline in circulation is all attributed to, you know, their stand on the war. But here's, you know, an industry that's hemorrhaging readers and is badly, you know, needed credibility. And yet here on something that's so important to the readers and so clear to the readers that, and they're afraid to do anything. It's, you know, it's quite striking and lamentable, at least in my view.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the New York Times in the larger sense as the agenda setter, I guess. Critics on the conservative and liberal end kind of say they are the agenda-setting media. They put their headline out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for what's going to be the lead in the next day's paper, and basically the rest of the papers in America are presumed to that they're supposed to follow suit and report what the Times is reporting.
Well, I mean, that's not strictly true, but certainly they have a disproportionate influence if you looked at their circulation and so forth. There's no logical reason why they would have that much, except their history, you know, the things they've done in the past, their you know, the quality of much of their reporting. So they still have this aura. So there's no question that they still, you know, they still have more influence than just about any other media outlet, which makes all the more important how careful they are with what they, you know, what they put on the front page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to see liberals, conservatives, and I know I do it too all the time. Is the New York Times? They're such liars. Look at what they're saying, this and that. But then we can all of us can turn it right around and say, see, even the New York Times admits it.
Well, I mean, look, I look at, read the Times every day carefully. I know there are a lot of people who just see, you know, they'll see one story and they'll say, oh, look, this is terrible and so forth. You know, so I see the good and the bad. You know, I read it carefully every day, and I, you know, so I see they have a lot of terrific reporters. They have a lot of terrific stories. They, you know, and as you said, there's a lot, the same blogs that may denounce the Times one day will then, you know, link to a story they have and say, you know, this proves whatever. This proves that Libby or this, you know, the domestic spying or whatever. And so they trumpet the Times when it serves their purposes, and then they denounce the Times. So, which I think is okay. I think you can pick and choose articles, but you can't on one day say the New York Times is, you know, is awful and it's all lies, and then the next day use them as a source. So,
right.
I think it's better to, you know, pick and choose and, you know, criticize things that you think are bogus, and you know, and praise them when they do good work, which they often do.
Yeah, my best example of that recently is, myself. Quoting David Sanger, who has so many times, I'll go ahead and say it, outright lied to the American people in terms of accusing North Korea of having a secret uranium enrichment program, when we know that that's not true at all, that all they ever got from AQ Khan was a bunch of junk from his garage sale that was good for nothing, that they made their nuclear bombs that they made out of plutonium that they harvested from old Russian reactors, not enriched uranium. It's pure lies, and he just acted as though this was absolute fact for, I don't know, years in a row.
Yeah.
And has also acted as though it's an absolute fact that somewhere in Iran there's a secret uranium enrichment program, which is meant to enrich to above 90% and make nuclear weapons. And yet in both cases, David Sanger has come out, never admitting that he was wrong or indicating in any way that this is contrary to anything he ever reported, but even David Sanger now will admit that, no, there is no uranium enrichment program in North Korea, and there wasn't one, and there's no evidence whatsoever that there's a secret nuclear program in Iran. If Iran was to make a bomb, the IAEA would have to leave first, and they have right. not done so. And even David Sanger in the New York Times finally gets it right.
Well, give him a pat on the back, I guess.
Yeah, well, they sure do work hard, whichever yeah. agenda it is they're pushing.
All right. Well, look, good talking to you. I have to get running here.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time on the show today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, everybody. Bye-bye. Greg Mitchell from Editor and Publisher. And, you know, one thing I didn't get to bring up here, and I guess I should have told him how long I expected him to stay on the phone here. But it was a short notice kind of interview. One thing noted in Greg Mitchell's article today on Editor and Publisher is that Michael R. Gordon recently told Charlie Rose on PBS he's in favor of the surge. Oh, the surge is a great idea. I think it ought to be given a chance to work, which puts Michael R. Gordon, New York Times reporter, in some very small percentage of the American people who think it's a good idea to increase the number of soldiers. You might remember that not too long ago, General Casey and General Abizade lost their job for opposing the surge. The whole thing was come up with as an excuse, simply, as there's nothing strategic about it. It's simply an excuse come up with by Frederick Kagan at the American Enterprise Institute to keep the war going longer. Whatever we do, we gotta counteract what they're trying to do, so let's call for the opposite. And that's what they got. And if you paid close attention, if you read the New York Times about George Bush's 4th of July speech to cadets in West Virginia, you'll know that it worked. The surge worked. The surge that was meant to keep American soldiers in Iraq has worked, and they're staying in Iraq. At least as far as the president is concerned, be prepared for more sacrifices and at least another year of war. Wait till September, until General Petraeus makes his announcement. Then start your clock. We'll have another year of war, and then get back to us in a year, and we'll sell you another year after that, too. That's Michael R. Gordon, a guy who agrees with Frederick Kagan at the American Enterprise Institute, a guy who ought to be writing under David Brooks' byline on the editorial page rather than pretending to be a journalist, which he's clearly not. And in fact, stay tuned. It's not up on the website yet. It'll be a little while, but we're going to celebrate Michael R. Gordon with a new bumper sticker at libertystickers.com. Michael R. Gordon, the worst reporter in the world. And in fact, there's two of them. The other one says, Michael R. Gordon and the New York Times telling the lies that lead to war. And don't anybody rip off those stickers. They're already not really copyrighted because I'm not a statist, but don't rip them off. They're going to be up on the website at libertystickers.com in the Scott Horton section soon. But here you go. I'm going to play some music and then come back and talk bad about the state some more. This here's The Descendants. All right, y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. It's Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And look, somebody's got to do it, so I'm going to go ahead and do the debunking here. Michael R. Gordon at the New York Times is full of it. He's a damn liar, and he knows it, and the things that he says are not true. So, and there are consequences to his lies, as discussed with Greg Mitchell, the White House Iraq group, basically the leaders of the Bush administration, all used Michael Gordon and Judy Miller's reporting in their little echo chamber. You know, of course, all their stories came from the vice president's office in the first place. Then they used this as the echo chamber to say, see, even the New York Times says that Iran is making nuclear weapons. See, even the New York Times says that Iran is making chemical weapons. See, even the New York Times says that Iraq is a terrible threat to the United States. And they're doing the same thing about Iran now. And warmongers like Senator Joseph Lieberman, who Al Gore wanted to be the vice president of the United States, remember that? He's coming out and saying, Iran is already at war against us. Iran has already declared war on us. Iran is killing our guys in Iraq. Based on the lies of Michael R. Gordon, the worst reporter in America. They're lies. It's just lies. What's that? Anonymous sources say. All right. You know, I just got an email, Scott at antiwar.com, from Tom Sumner, who complains that Greg Mitchell stole his thunder, that the bloggers actually do a really good job of taking apart Michael R. Gordon. And I'll tell you, the blog A Tiny Revolution by Jonathan Schwartz does a great job of that. In fact, when Michael R. Gordon reported the patently false accusations that Iran is behind all the bombs that are killing American soldiers in Iraq, Jonathan Schwartz had this long paragraph. I mean, it was a block quote on the blog A Tiny Revolution, and it was, you know, almost a foot long or something, a half a foot long, this block quote. And where he cut out everything except all the times that Michael R. Gordon reported, anonymous sources said, a source told me, some guy claimed. And he literally, he quoted supposedly or paraphrased anonymous sources dozens of times in the article and never quoted anyone who was willing to put their name on it. And it was all just patently false accusations. We all remember, don't we, in April when Reuters and the Christian Science Monitor reported on the statement of Lieutenant Colonel Scott Blackwell, who was leading a raid against members of the Mahdi Army Sadrist Militia, who said that they found a factory about 100 miles south of Baghdad that made the EFPs, the explosively formed penetrators, right there in Iraq. And various intelligence sources have come out and said that, actually, this is a British design that was accidentally leaked to the Irish Republican Army and was sold to, you know, global terrorist black market types from there. And that, you know, you don't have to be the Iranian government to produce a homemade landmine. And here they have these factories cranking them out in Iraq. So now, does that mean that no bombs are coming from Iran at all? Guess not, but I haven't seen any evidence at all. None. And I look. I've been paying attention. I've seen no evidence that the Iranian government or even Iran at all, people in Iran at all, have been involved in selling weapons, especially these EFPs, to anybody in Iraq. That's simply the accusation against them. There's been no proof leveled. And the lie is that these bombs must be coming from Iran because they're so sophisticated. But that's not true. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Blackwell reports they found a factory that makes these things within 100 miles of Baghdad. which means that anyone who says that these bombs must be coming from Iran is a liar. Or they are so stupid that they believe the things that Michael R. Gordon reports in the New York Times. And reports, of course, gets the ironic quotes there. It's lies. And they say the same thing about Afghanistan. Oh, yeah, the reason that American soldiers are getting killed in Afghanistan, yeah, that's because Iran is backing the Taliban. What a lie. The Taliban's getting their weapons from Pakistan and from other places in Afghanistan. You know, anybody can tell you could probably find 50 sources or 100 within a minute on Google to tell you that Afghanistan is awash with weapons. And has been, and will be, and they come from all around. I just read an article said, oh yeah, the Taliban, they're making a killing off of me. I'm their weapon salesman. What I do is I go up north and I buy a bunch of guns, and then I come back here and mark them up $100 a piece. It's great. I just read that last week, 2 weeks ago. Reporters on the ground interviewing the arms salesman in Iraq. They go, oh yeah, I go up there and buy them from the Tajiks. And come down back down here and sell them to the Pashtuns. They've got a greater demand for them. They're trying to fight off an occupying force. So they'll pay a higher price. And now there's, and this is something that also didn't get to mention in the, or get Greg Mitchell to talk about in the interview there, is that American generals, including the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, they have come out and downplayed all this. This is the way this goes. Michael R. Gordon makes some crazy accusations in the New York Times, and then somebody asks the Secretary of Defense about it, and he goes, nah, well, you know, we don't really have any evidence that the Iranian government's behind doing anything to our guys, other than backing the same troops that our guys are training and backing and installing as the government. And that cuts to the core of the essence of the hypocrisy and the lies about Iran and about American policy in Iraq right now. The government of Iraq is the Iran parties. It's the Dawood Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, both of which are tied to Iran, both of which lived in Iran for 30 years. They were exiles in Iran from the time that Jimmy Carter asked Saddam Hussein to invade Iran through 2003. They lived in Iran. They are the Iran parties. If you've listened to this show, you've heard me interview, I don't know, 50 different people explaining the very same thing. That's the fact. America's backing Iran and Iraq while we're accusing them of backing our enemies. And as I mentioned in the interview with Greg Mitchell there, they say, oh, they're giving weapons and training to Iraqi extremists. That is vague on purpose. It's because it's a lie. If they identify who it is that Iran is supposedly arming, we will be able to see through that lie. It's simple. Just replace Iraqi extremists with an actual accusation. Iran is giving these bombs to the Sunni insurgency. Well, that is an American policy to back both sides of a war, including our enemies in one. But seems pretty unlikely to me that Iran is backing the Sunni insurgency, which is fighting quite successfully, fighting off America and Iran's puppet Iraqi government's attempts to consolidate power over them. Why would they be arming the Sunnis when their goal is subjugating them? You see, it makes no sense. Also, there's no evidence. Okay, now let's finish the sentence another way. The Iranians are, you know, all these weapons, supplying all these weapons to Iraq, not to the Sunni insurgency, but to the Badr Brigades of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution. Well, they're Iraqi extremists, but they're our Iraqi extremists. They're the government of Iraq that we've put in power. You can Google images and find the picture of Bush meeting with Abdulaziz Hakim last December. They're the best of friends. So if Iran is backing the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and their death squads, the Badr Brigades, then thank you, Iran. You sure are wonderful pro-American patriotic partners in our coalition of the willing, helping us to train up and finance the Badr Brigades to rule Iraq forever. Thank you. So now we got to try to finish Michael R. Gordon's lie in the New York Times that Iran is funding and training Iraqi extremists. And let's plug in Muqtada al-Sadr as the variable. Well, Muqtada al-Sadr is not our enemy. There have been minor skirmishes, but for the most part, America hasn't had a real battle with the Sadr forces since the stalemate, since the draw in August of 2004. And furthermore, Sadr is a nationalist. Sadr is not backed by Iran. I just interviewed Robert Dreyfus all about this. One of the best reporters in the world on the subject. Just wrote a massive new article for The Prospect on this. Sadr is not a puppet of Iran. And Sadr is not at war with the United States. His entire strategy that he announced publicly, you know, at prayers on Friday afternoon was, hey, the Americans are surging in a bunch of troops. Don't fight them. Put your AK under your bed, go home, and wait them out. We don't want battles in Sadr City. Don't fight them. Be cool. Everyone be cool. So if Iran is giving EFPs to Sadr, yeah, big deal. He's part of the Iraqi government too, even though the Americans don't like him because he's a nationalist and wants us out. So there you see, Michael R. Gordon is a liar. Michael R. Gordon is a damned liar, and he knows that he's a damned liar. And that's why he says Iran is backing Iraqi extremists. Because if he's any more specific, you'll be able to tell that he's completely full of shit. Michael R. Gordon is a liar. Michael R. Gordon is a disgrace. If I was Michael R. Gordon's brother, I'd kick his ass. But since I don't know the guy, I can only, you know, try to shame him from my little perch here. And by the way, anybody wants to read up good material about the accusations of Iran supplying these bombs, killing our soldiers in Iraq, which are pure bull, look up Gareth Porter at the American Prospect at IPS News and his archives, antiwar.com/Porter. He has taken on this lie repeatedly and demolished it. So you have no excuse, my friends, to believe that Iran is killing our guys in Iraq. I just showed you that they're lying to you, and I also recommended to you where you can find the truth instead. So don't tell me. Iran's already declared war against us. Iran already started the war. We have to defend ourselves, like Joe Lieberman, the liar, says. And I want to end up the show real quick with mentioning the Spotlight article today on antiwar.com. I'm sorry, I was going to cover the oil law here. Maybe I can get Greg Palast on to talk about this stupid oil law next week if I'm lucky. I want to focus on the Spotlight. Antiwar.com today. If Iran were America and we were Iran, and it's a timeline, a history of American relations with Iran with all the roles reversed. Iran backing Mexico's invasion of America, overthrowing Eisenhower, and installing Joe McCarthy as the dictator. Then McCarthy being overthrown by the born-again Christians, and etc. like that. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's the Spotlight on antiwar.com today. If Iran were America and we were Iran by Jeffrey L. Bryan, and it's also available at lewrockwell.com. That's it for Antiwar Radio today. Thanks everybody very much for listening. I'll be back here Monday from 11 to 1 to tell you what a liar Michael R. Gordon at the New York Times is. And now you gotta just be patient while I find a song I want to play. Hey, how about some more Motorhead? We'll be right back.
the end of things, so you're still proud.